This is East End Inc. Today we present Christine Sneed and Roberta Montgomery reading from Love in the Time of Time's Up and Susan Scarf Merrill talking about how women read Moby Dick. To begin, here is Marianne Callendrell of Canio's Books in Sag Harbor.
I am so thrilled to present this anthology. It's a short fiction anthology edited by one of our guests, Christine Sneed, called Love in the Time of Time's Up. It's so perfect, it's so timely, it's so necessary, and it's fiction, which makes it extra interesting. The book itself includes 17 stories written by 16 writers, and interestingly, it was published one day before the fifth anniversary of the New York Times story by Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey. You may recall the story that broke the Harvey Weinstein series of sexual assaults going on for decades and kind of launched the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement. And, you know, this couldn't be more relevant to our present moment. With pathos and insight, I'm so pleased to say there's such a variety of stories here, but each author skillfully explores the complexities of desire, intention, and what it means to be a woman in our current time. So we have the editor, Christine Sneed, here with us. Christine is author of several books, including the novel Please Be Advised, A Little Known Facts, The Virginity of Famous Men, and Paris, He Said, among others. She has a short story collection, Direct Sunlight. Her work has appeared in the Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Prize Stories Anthology, among other publications. And joining Christine, and thanks to Roberta Montgomery, who came in one day and we were talking and she mentioned the publication, and I said, Roberta, we have to do something with this book. Roberta is the former editor at The Atlantic. She has written and produced many television game shows. Short fiction has appeared in a number of small magazines, most recently Chicago Quarterly Review. So the two will be talking together about the anthology and reading a little bit of their contributions to the anthology.
The elevator, Karen Bender. She was riding the elevator to her first job as an assistant at a music magazine. The world fell away as she rose to the 15th floor. She was 20 years old. During the few months she had worked in this office, she had learned how to move names from column A to column B for event invites, make a collated set of Xerox copies, carry a cardboard box full of 6 different coffee orders. There was something remarkable and sparkling about all of it, the fact that each morning she entered the waiting room and did not have to remain there like the others, but was allowed to walk through the doors into the crammed gray hallways. The glaring fluorescent lighting stretched across the ceiling, the glass-windowed offices surrounding the main area like individual aquariums. She loved all of it. Entering the offices was like walking into a stranger's enormous beating heart. She went to work each morning, hoping the editors might soon trust her with more interesting tasks, for she wanted to show them everything she was capable of, which was endless and vast. However, each day they asked her, barely looking at her, to do the same dull things. But today she wanted to change the editor's view of what she could do. She was going to ask for more responsibility. She had practiced this with her roommate, was thinking about how to set up an interview with the lead singer of the Go-Go's. If she should just call the musician's publicist or ask the editor first. It was a slightly shabby elevator in need of renovation, with the feel of the bathroom from the 1970s. The pink artificial marble-like panels faded, like almost invisible veins. The carpet was the color of a pale sky and always held the bitter odor of cleaning chemicals. The doors closed. She stood, examining the numbers flashing on the strip at the top of the elevator, and was only vaguely aware of a man standing in the elevator with her, and that they were alone. The man turned to her and said, "I could rape you." Her thoughts, curving in one direction, stopped. They looked at each other. He smiled, as though this were a joke. An iciness flashed through her. She was new to office buildings, and she didn't know. Was this a joke men in offices made? He was of indeterminate age, perhaps 40 or 50, the age in which men developed a soft, vulnerable chin. His skin was a pinkish shade of pale, as though he never got out in the sun. The low lights in the elevator made him look glazed, made of ceramic. She remembered how he looked at her then, rapt, as though this was a discussion they had been having. She remembered wanting to ignore the statement and get back to her previous thoughts, but her thinking had been stopped by this. The man moved toward her and she stepped back, and he touched her shoulder in a way that appeared strangely paternal, except for the fact that his other hand reached over and squeezed her breast, just for a moment, feeling it as though he wanted to test its presence. She felt her body gasp. She understood that, in this moment, anything could happen. The elevator doors opened. He darted out without looking back. The doors closed, and she was alone in the elevator now, which slowly took her to the 15th floor. Potpourri. It always started with eye contact. Lucy would focus on one man until he felt the heat of her gaze, and if he looked back at her with a certain serious glint, she knew it had begun. He would ask the bartender to send her a drink, or else he would glide over and introduce himself before he ordered her an overpriced martini or a glass of wine. It was best if he was over 40 and not too handsome. The younger, better-looking men didn't have to pay for it, unless this was specifically what they were trawling for. It was also best if the man she set her sights on had come to the bar with a group. Solitary men were bigger risks. A few were there purposely to look for someone like her. If she scratched beneath their veneer of public politeness, a strong hint of suppressed anger or resentment greeted her. They had something to prove, although some of them did not want to be bothered at all because their intention that night was to obliterate their personalities with alcohol. And in these cases, there was no time or energy for anything else. She did not do threesomes. She had no pimp or protector. She had a regular job. Sex with strangers was something she did on the side when she needed money, or was lonely and restless, or, on occasion, both. Her birthday was tomorrow, her 34th. It was just after 9 o'clock, and she was in the Swiss Hotel bar on West Wacker Drive, drinking a gin and tonic, pretending to look at her phone as she surveyed the room. She was a natural blonde with hazel brown eyes. If asked her age, she told the men she was 27. Most of them believed her. Some claimed she looked younger. She started sleeping with men for money the year after college, when she earned a barely subsistence-level salary in the philosophy department's administrative office at the same university where she accrued $80,000 in loans over the 4 years she was enrolled as an international studies major. Even with three roommates, her rent and loan payments were more than she could afford most months if she wanted to eat something other than beans and macaroni and rice and go out with her friends a few times a month. Her parents were divorced and both said they didn't have any extra money to give her. She was, no surprise to her, on her own, as she had been more or less since high school graduation.
July 2nd, 1982. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been like, 4 days, 1 week, and maybe 3 months since my last confession? Since then, I've, like, taken the Lord's name in vain a bunch. I've lost my temper. I mean, I really lose my temper a lot, particularly with my mom. I hate it when she asks me if I've been drinking. Duh. Everyone at Georgetown Prep drinks, unless you're a loser or gay. Oops. Sorry, Father. I like beer. I really like beer. Hey, Father, do you like beer? And other booze, too. Like last weekend at the beach house, I got totally hammered on Everclear and Gatorade. I ralphed all over the living room and the hallway and the bathroom. Squee said he had to pull my head out of the toilet, but I think he was exaggerating and trying to gross me out. I do know I passed out because I woke up in the bathtub covered in baby oil and wasn't sure how I got there. I've like a ton of pressure on me from school, and booze helps. I'd explode otherwise. 1600 on my SATs won't get me into Yale. That's bullshit. Oh, sorry for the language, Father. Let's see, what else? Oh yeah, I've disrespected my parents. Like I've said, they don't know how much I like beer. I lied to them about what went on last week at the beach house. I said I was going away to find peace and quiet so I could study. I took all my test prep books and my calculator and vocab flashcards and made a big show of putting them in the car. I said Timmy and Judge and Squee and me were going to do test prep together. The only testing we did was seeing who could drink the most. We joked around a lot about boffing and devil's triangles and how easy Renata Schroeder is. Me and the rest of the guys are Renata alums. But I'm still a virgin, Father. That's good, my son. Chastity is the cornerstone of holiness and happiness. Well, I should be really happy then. For all these sins, and especially the sins against purity, honesty, and humility, I ask absolution and penance from you, Father. August 3rd, 1982. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 2 days, 3 weeks since my last confession. Father, I think a lot about girls. If you knew what I mean, I guess you could say I have impure thoughts. I think about them all the time. That is natural, my son. But girls want nothing to do with me, Father, especially the popular girls. I don't hate them, but they don't make it easy for me to like them either. At least that's the way it seems. Other guys know how to get somewhere with girls. I know guys who are crappy athletes and total stoners and losers who get tons of girls. I'm on the varsity football team, the captain of the basketball team. I still get nowhere with girls. Who am I, the Hunchback of Notre Dame? I hit on a shy girl from Holton Arms, 2 years younger, not my type. Judge was in the room watching me go for it. He totally egged me on. She yelled for me to stop and bit my hand. Afterwards, I jacked it. I mean, I abused myself, Father. I have abused myself many times. I got wasted that night and blew off Calc BC the next morning. I'm letting my parents down. I am sorry for these sins and the sins of my past life, and especially the sins against purity, honesty, and humility. I ask absolution and penance from you, Father. February 20, 1984. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 2 months and 1 year since my last confession. I took my roommate's parka without asking, and when he was out of the room, I grabbed coins from his desk. I have been impure with myself many times. I have looked at pornographic magazines and once hid myself in the dorm bathroom to watch a girl shower. I masturbated. Twice I didn't return phone calls from my mother. I lied to her about the amount of money I need for books and bought alcohol instead. I have been drunk on many occasions. I like beer. I really like beer. Do you like beer, Father? I cheated on a test in econ. I have disrespected women. At a party, I shoved my penis in a girl's face. We were all drunk. Everyone laughed. It's not like I was hard or anything. The girl's name is Debbie, and she's Puerto Rican. I bet that's how she got into Yale. I have been guilty of homosexual activity because when I hear my roommate masturbate, it excites me, so I masturbate. I made fun of a food server in the dining hall who is black and wears a hearing aid. I called him Little Deaf Sambo. All my friends laughed, and now we all call him that. Probably I should stop. I wrestle with feelings of pride. I work hard. I'm smarter than most everyone I meet, even at Yale. I have a temper. I use the Lord's name in vain when I lose my temper. I ask absolution and penance from you, Father. December 22nd, 1998. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 3 months and 2 years since my last confession. These are my sins. I've missed Mass many times. I have committed blasphemy. When I lose my temper, I take the Lord's name in vain. On several occasions, I have drunk to excess, beer mostly. I like beer. I have a temper and I have intense feelings of envy. Our president, a Rhodes Scholar, he hauls out his stupid saxophone to play Heartbreak Hotel and Arsenio and Women Swoon. Give me a break. We're going to see him impeached. He'll be the second president in history. Let's see how smart he seems then. Envy is a dangerous emotion, my son. Look to Mark 15:10. For Pilate knew the chief priest handed Jesus over because of envy. Bill Clinton is no Jesus, Father. He's an Arkansas hustler. He didn't inhale? Right. His IQ rivals Thomas Jefferson? Right. We're going to humiliate and destroy him. The capital sin of envy can destroy you if not resisted. You must reject it and conquer these feelings through the grace of God. Father, can I still feel envy and be on the side of right? Clinton disgraced his office, the legal system, and the American people. He's going down. When tempted to fall into envy, turn to Mary and pray to her, my son. Say a quick Hail Mary when tempted to be jealous. Be thankful and praise God with Mary's hymn of praise. My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God, my Savior. Father, I told Ken he should reveal every depraved detail we uncover. I'm adamant the people should know the truth, and the truth is pure smut. The guy's a freak. You know, he stuck a cigar in Monica Lewinsky's vagina. He had phone sex with her 15 times. She sucked him off in the Oval Office 9 times. He came in her mouth 2 times in the Oval Office, Father. He beat off in a trash can. He fingered her on the Resolute desk. This is what's going on in the Clinton presidency. The people need to know. He will be questioned under oath and forced to answer. He will be disgraced, Father. I'm exercising my faith the best way I can, using the opportunities the Lord gives me through the prosecution of righteous justice. I hate him, Father. Hatred is not a sin, but St. Augustine advised, cum delictione hominem et odium victorum. Hate the sin, but not the sinner. That is a Christian goal that may be beyond me, Father. For these sins and all the sins of my past life, especially the sins against purity, honesty, charity, humility, I ask absolution and penance from you, Father. October 11, 2018. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 7 months and 2 years since my last confession. In the privacy of my home, I took my wife and daughters into my arms and lied to them. The fear in their eyes was assuaged as I passionately denied I ever touched that Blasey woman. My family's love for me is now pinned to that lie. And on the most public of stages, I lied under oath to the nation. Yes, I fondled Christine Blasey. I locked the door and pushed her down on the bed and ground myself into her and ran my hands over her body. And when she screamed, I held my hand over her mouth so no one could hear. That is her story, and I believe her. Honestly, I was too drunk at the time to recall the details and offer a different, more convincing version of that night. What I do remember is that it meant nothing to me, and I committed no sin of fornication. I deserve my rightful place on the Supreme Court. I am a righteous man, and I know the righteous way. Do you know, Father, that for the past 15 years, I've had the most conservative voting record on the D.C. court? On the court, I am serving God, damn it. My face is everywhere you look. Magazines, newspapers, television. My high school yearbook picture is seared into the nation's imagination. And when half the country sees my 17-year-old hopeful face, they see a sexual predator. When I was a teenager, I got carried away, groped a girl. I hardly remember. The Clinton vengeance seekers and the Me Too witches want to see me emasculated. If Christine Blasey Ford was their hero, I had to make myself into a bigger victim than she was. That's what our president wanted. He wanted yelling and full denial. So I yelled and sniveled and cried with my family forced to watch my humiliation. I lied. I perjured myself in front of the nation. Before you and God, I confess and tell the truth and ask for forgiveness. I represented myself as an innocent man because I was. I had confessed my sins. Isn't that the deal, Father? I got washed clean. Do you think the conspiracy wanting to deny me my place on the bench understands the sacrament? All they understand is vengeance, not the Lord's mercy. I will perjure myself in the court of man, but until the honor of the Senate and the honor of God become one, I will be judged by God alone. In the divine sacrament of our Lord, I have been absolved. I have been washed clean. Believe me, Father, someday they will come for you too. Do you know Matthew 5:10, Father? I'm sure you do. It's become a favorite passage of mine late. Blessed are they who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. For these sins and all the sins of my past life, especially the sins against purity, chastity, honesty, charity, humility, I ask one more time for absolution and penance from you, Father. February 11th, 2022. Hey, Father, it's been a while. 2 years and 3 months since my last confession. Funny to be here asking you for forgiveness. I can't really recall many sins. I guess the big one would be pride. Things are going very well for me. After being vilified by half the country as a drunken frat boy rapist, I have won. And the church has won. Do we need more guns, more babies? Is it time to end Roe v. Wade? I decide. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. I am being satisfied, Father. You know, there are 7 of us on the Supreme Court, Father. Catholics, I'm talking. 7 Catholics out of 9 judges. Is that wild or what? That's like 1 judge for every deadly sin. I suppose this is where I ask absolution, Father, for all my sins, especially the sins against purity, chastity, honesty, and humility. That should cover it. So I just wanted to say, I wrote this like a year and a half before Roe was overturned.
This is East End, Inc. We heard Christine Sneed and Roberta Montgomery reading from Love in the Time of Time's Up. The book was edited by Christine Sneed. It was published in October 2022 by Tortoise Books. Next, here is Susan Scarf Merrill in a talk on how women read Moby Dick, recorded recently at Canio's Books.
When you read the book, you can't believe it. He's completely self-educated, you know, and he actually taught school in his teens. So it tells you that though he had not finished school, he was deemed worthy of teaching it. When he was 19 or 20, he got on a boat, a merchant ship. He needed money. He needed to make a living. He got on a boat. He sailed in various capacities for about 5 years. So from the age of, let's say he came back here at the age of 25. And among the experiences that he had been in the Navy. He had abandoned, I've lost the word. What's the word when you run away from your ship? He deserted. Thank you. Sorry. Words. So he had deserted from one ship. He had lived among cannibals for a while. I mean, he had just had a huge number of weird and fascinating experiences. So he comes back to this country. He moves in with his family, and he writes first a book called Typee, and then a book called Omu, and they were both about his experiences off in the islands, and they were a little bit, they weren't dirty books, but they weren't clean books, you know, for the time. So this is the 1840s. He, you know, is writing about, you know, bare-breasted natives and being, you know, women sort of taking the sailors into the forest, and just, they were titillating books, and each of those books sold about 10,000 copies, which was quite good. It would also be pretty good now, you know. So then he wrote 3 more books, and each of those, this guy is starting to emerge. They're a little more thematic, they're a little darker, they're a little bit more cerebral, his voice is different. I mean, he's just starting to become the Herman Melville that wrote this book. And so at the age of 30, He moves. He's married. I actually can't remember. He has children, I'm pretty sure, but don't quote me.
Yeah, does? He does.
Yeah. And he moves to the area of Massachusetts where Hawthorne is, and they become friends. And he's working on this story, which is a story that there are kind of two backstories for it. One is the sinking of the whale ship Essex, which Nathaniel Philbrick wrote about, and you should all read. It's quite wonderful. And the other is a weird little book that came out in, I think, mid-1820s, which is the story of Mocha Dick, a whale who eats a boat. So he has this backstory and this material, and he's writing a book that is pretty much the story of the whale, and he meets Hawthorne, and they start talking about what the book should be, and Hawthorne gets the kind of gives him the push to make this more of a story about not just whaling, but about the larger issues. And at one point, he says, I think he writes to Hawthorne, "I've written a wicked book." It takes him about a year and a half to write this book. It comes out in 1851 in London. And I will now segue to the larger picture, which is that in the years from 1851 till his death in the 1890s, it sold 3,700 copies in total. So it didn't do very well. People didn't like it. They thought it was a weird book. And there are a couple of things that are important to think about when you think about the fact that the book didn't matter so much in its own time in the way that it does now. And one is that this was a deeply religious, high church country. This was a country where everybody knew everything about their God, the God of religion, and the stories that are in here and the references that are in here were easily accessible to everybody. It was a different world than our world. So one of the challenges we face when we read this book is we don't know where Tophet is, and we may not know the story of Jonah and the whale. There are a lot of things that we might not know when we come to this book that were really accessible to and known to the people who originally read it, the 3,000 people who originally read it. So something happened in the, you know, in the beginning of the sort of 1920s, late 19-teens, which was that a number of very famous authors in different, D.H. Lawrence, Faulkner, all started saying to people, this is the best book that ever was. This book is about everything. If there's a book, I think it's Faulkner who said, if there was a book that I wish I had written, it would be this book. The book suddenly has, you know, sort of transitioned from being a book that's basically forgotten to being this ur-text of our culture.
We heard Susan Scoff Merrill talking about how women read Moby Dick. Upcoming events on the East End include on Thursday, May the 25th at 6 p.m., photographer Galen Rosenwax and ecologist Carl Safina discuss their work studying sperm whales in their natural environment at Sag Harbor's John Germain Library. The marathon reading of Moby Dick starts on Friday, June the 9th at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor at noon. It continues at various locations through Sunday, June the 11th. Details are at caniosculturalcafe.org. East End Inc. programs are archived at moreeastendinc.blogspot.com. East End Inc. was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Catherine Zocher and Marianne Callendrill. This is Hazel Kahn.